Coming to you today from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we talk with film critic Claudia Puig about what festival movies she's seen and which ones have stayed with her. Then, Jake Gyllenhaal plays an art critic in the new film Velvet Buzzsaw. He tells us how his own views about the value of criticism have evolved.
More and more, I think over the years, I've found it a lot funnier. And playing a critic and finding humor in a critic has given me the opportunity to separate myself from that.
And a documentary about the origins of the 1979 film Alien takes a deep dive into the famous chestburster scene. All that after this short break.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm your host, John Horn. We are coming to you today from the 2019 Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. We have been seeing as many films as we can here, as has our next guest. Film critic Claudia Puig is the president of the LA Film Critics Association. Claudia, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
So there have been a lot of dark stories, a lot of depressing stories, both documentary and narrative. Knock Down the House. This is a movie about four women who are running for Congress, three for House of Representatives, one for the U.S. Senate. But one of the candidates who has followed is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who I think we all know does win. Let's talk a little bit more about this film.
It's going to go down as kind of an artifact, I think, of what's going, you know, the movement that's going on. And it really, she got fairly unprecedented access to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and to Amy Villela and to Cori Bush and Paula Jean Swearingen. So those were, she followed those four candidates. Obviously, we know that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got, you know, won and the other three did not, but they are going to be running again and they showed up. Unfortunately, I think because of the shutdown or for various reasons, Cortez could not be there, but she was there virtually. She was there on a big screen and she was wonderful. And so were the other three women who were there. But anyway, the film itself just got amazing. I have never sat through a Sundance movie where people are cheering and yelling and people are weeping. And they're just like this level of excitement, and you really feel like there's something, you know, like between the Women's March and all this, you felt a sense of like this movement is taking hold and it's really hit a chord. And
no,
it was
to
great.
Me, it played like Rocky. And the amazing thing about the film and the filmmaking is that we are with the Congresswoman as she sees the results coming in. She has no idea. She, according to her own polling, she is down by like 30 points before the vote. She's running against a longtime incumbent.
Crowley.
And we see her come into her election party, and she has no idea that she's doing well and that she's winning. And that shot alone, I think, is worth the price of admission.
That was fantastic. And you learn so much about their lives. Particularly, I mean, there's more of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez than there is of the other three. And I'm sure that was edited after she won for good reason. And she has a wonderful, they all had great personal stories, but hers, she talks about her father and she talks about visiting the Washington Monument and, you know, how he said, this is yours, this is all of ours. And it was so inspiring. And then, you know, she died when she was in college and she talks about how, you know, his final words to her were, make me proud, and she hopes that she has. And it really, I felt like you got a sense of who these women were. They're all working class women. You know, none of them are politicos. And you get the sense of this really fantastic brewing movement. And and from sitting in that audience, my God, I mean, I just couldn't, cheering in the middle of the movie, like, you know, 10 times. It was amazing.
So I'm going to go from Knock Down the House to a much, much darker film. It's called Leaving Neverland. This is a story about Michael Jackson and about his alleged sexual attacks on two very young boys who are now adult men. You sat through, what, all 4 hours?
All 4 hours.
Tell us a little bit about this movie and the survivors of these alleged attacks were there as well. What was your takeaway from the film?
My takeaway was they were very credible accounts and very detailed and very painful to listen to and to absorb. And you do have an opportunity to really absorb it because they go into really excruciating detail. And you get a sense of what this has done to, of course, what it's done to them, but also what it's done to their families. They both were married and have small children. And I think it was that realization when they had young children of their own, you know, they looked at the innocence of their own children and realized what had done, what had been done to their own innocence. And also it created, I think, greater rifts with their respective parents or their mothers, particularly with the idea that, you know, why didn't you protect me? You know, if the situation had been different and a 45 or whatever he was, a grown man had wanted to take your child to his house and sleep in the same bedroom, you know, most mothers would know better than to ever allow that. But because it was Michael Jackson, they did. And so there's so many issues that are raised in this, and it's very powerful. It's very difficult to sit through.
There are a couple other documentaries that I've seen that I've really enjoyed seeing up here. One is called American Factory, about a Chinese company taking over an abandoned GM plant to make auto glass in Ohio. Another one that I liked a lot was called Hail Satan, which is really about religious tolerance and religious freedom in the United States. I want to talk now, though, about some narrative films, because there are obviously a lot of narrative features. A couple have sold for a lot of money, Late Night and The Farewell. What have been the narrative features that you have seen that have really made an impression on you?
Then one of the narratives that made a huge impression was Loose. It feels a little bit like a play, and that's in no way an insult or anything detrimental. It does it in the best possible way, in the sense that you're raising important issues, and it raises important issues, and it explores our expectations. It looks into racism. It looks into exceptionalism. It looks into blind spots and perceptions. And the main actor who plays the title character, Kelvin Harrison Jr., gives an incredible performance. And I feel like it's really a conversation starter, and it's something completely different from what we've seen before.
This is a movie about a white couple in a well-to-do white couple in some suburban town who have adopted a black boy who is fleeing conflict in Africa.
Eritrea.
And the question is he the greatest student that this school has ever seen, or is something else going on? I agree, it's a very provocative, you know, disturbing film that I thought about a lot last night. We're now about a third of the way through the festival. I think the Frame team has seen probably more than two dozen movies at this point. What about you? What's your tally? Or do you not even want to count?
I haven't counted yet, and I'm still seeing some today. It'll probably be close to that, yeah.
Claudia Puig is the president of the LA Film Critics Association. She is also a frequent guest on Film Week on KPCC's Air Talk. Claudia, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Jake Gyllenhaal is at Sundance with a new movie. He tells us why he was compelled to make the very frightening Velvet Buzzsaw.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times calls it passionate, emotional, and fearless, and AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm your host, John Horn. We're coming to you from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. Last April, I visited the Los Angeles film set of writer-director Dan Gilroy's film, Velvet Buzzsaw. In the movie, Jake Gyllenhaal plays an art critic named Morf Vanderwalt. Gyllenhaal had last worked with Gilroy on the 2014 thriller Nightcrawler, which Gilroy wrote and directed. It was a movie about a news cameraman with some very unsavory methods of capturing footage. On the day I visited the set of Velvet Buzzsaw, they had transformed the LA Convention Center to resemble the massive contemporary art fair, Art Basel, in Miami. I spoke with Gilroy and Gyllenhaal on the set that day, but they were very cagey about what the film was really about. So it was only when I actually saw Velvet Buzzsaw that I understood what a terrifying and twisted film it really is. In this scene, Gyllenhaal's character tells a gallery owner, played by Rene Russo, that a late artist's canvases are, well, haunted.
They were surprised to hear Deese's art was being sold. Apparently, he left explicit instructions that it all be destroyed.
What are you saying?
Stop selling Deese!
Set in the contemporary art scene in LA, the film takes a darkly satirical view of the connection between art and commerce, and then things get very, very scary. When Jake Gyllenhaal and I chatted before the premiere of Velvet Buzzsaw here at Sundance, I asked him how he'd describe the film's tone.
I would say it's half satire, half horror. But I think it's generally some sort of comment on being, I think, maybe suffocated by the tsunami of capitalism, regardless of whatever job you do. But Dan has seemed to pick the art world as a pretty formidable representation of how, you know, your individual self and what you believe in can be taken over by greed.
I think the differences between your last film with Dan, Nightcrawler, and Velvet Buzzsaw are pretty obvious, but I think the similarities are even more obvious. How would you describe what they share in common?
I feel like he writes parables, you know? I think he's someone who tries to give fair warning of what he sees. I, deeply loving Dan Gilroy, not only as an artist but as a human being, would say that he's a bit of a prophet in that way, but also ballsy enough to speak about what he sees. And I think says it in a very entertaining way. And I think we are sort of living in a satire slash horror film right now. And somehow the movies that he's made, Nightcrawler in particular, I think was prescient at the time, but also I think kind of prophetic. And I think the same thing here.
In terms of what it had to say about news, in terms of what it had to say about how people get attention, how would you... Because there's so many different ways to read Nightcrawler
totally.
And how it relates to today.
I think I always said when I was talking about that movie, and still do, that we created Lou Bloom. You know, we created that character in Nightcrawler, and we feed him. You have to feed a parasite. And I think that we are complicit in creating leaders and different personalities that we begin to worship who are very much like him. And I think Velvet Buzzsaw is... really a comment, I think, probably from Dan, and he can speak for himself. But the way I felt was a comment on his business and our business, the entertainment business, and where it's headed.
There was an amazing documentary that came out last year called The Price of Everything. And it's really about who gets to assign value to art. You know, how do auction houses play in it? You know, what artists do? Kind of the commodification of art. And I couldn't help but thinking that there is a real parallel between this film and that documentary about who decides what is and is not valuable and what that value is. Is it the fact that it's in a collection? Is it the fact that it sells for a certain price? Is it the fact that a critic likes it? Seems like one of the most important themes in this movie, in Velvet Buzzsaw, is like, what is valued? And how do you assign value to something that doesn't have a tangible value?
I mean, I think also, how do we value ourselves? I mean, that's again, like what Dan keeps doing is he keeps bringing it back to, it's a bit of a satire, but I mean, I happened to be recently for fun, for no other reason, but for fun, because I did have delved into the art world and have made some friends and find it fascinating. The artists and also I think the buyers. I was at the auction where the David Hockney was sold for $90 million. And it was quite an experience to see that piece of art up on a wall and then anonymously have it be sold for this sort of exorbitant amount of money. It was very hard to even kind of comprehend, I think, given the state of the world as well. But I think for me, when I think about Dan and all the things that I've learned from his movies, it always turns me inward. What do I actually value? Can I actually ask myself that question? If there's something shiny in front of me, would I go for that over something else?
We're talking with Jake Gyllenhaal about his new movie, Velvet Buzzsaw. Your character is an art critic, and he is an art critic who takes kind of personal pleasure, I think, in hurting people.
I mean, kind of.
Well,
I mean,
let's just say that he recognizes that his words can help and hurt.
Yeah.
And sometimes he does use those words for the wrong purposes, not because of what he feels, but because he recognizes what their reactions could cause.
Yeah.
And when you start thinking about criticism, the way that it's wielded by this character, do you start thinking about criticism in general? And were there people or critics that you thought about in terms of how you were going to approach this character?
Yes, there were. I think with every role you play, if you haven't played someone with a real job, you develop an empathy for whatever it is that they do. And so, yeah, I have a completely different perspective on critique, and even probably potential critique of my own work, you know, because I think actually a critic is trying to communicate something that is their, obviously their opinion, and it is based on experience of the moment. You know, in a place like Sundance, I always ask the journalists who are watching all of these movies. I mean, there are a lot of movies, and I've had the privilege to be on The Jury at Cannes and The Jury at Berlin. And when you watch close to 30 movies in a period of 2 weeks, I think that quality of something comes through, but I'm not sure sometimes what that is, you know? And I admire it, and I'm kind of in awe of the fact that they can even do it. And, you know, I'm almost like, I become very aware of that now, and I have a respect for it. And I think also for me, I find, I mean, Jerry Saltz and those types of, those, you know, I think I
Jerry actually, Saltz is the art critic of New York Magazine.
Yes. I think that he was a pretty tremendous influence on the way my mind worked. And then we had a lot of external people who actually, the way I look, I think I was influenced by. One of them actually being a random picture of Marlon Brando, because I think what's interesting about this critic, not just only that he critiques art, but that I think his name is Morf van der Walt, and Morf is such an extraordinary name and really describes him. He morphs himself in moments to sort of fit where he is, and that's a very interesting thing for a critic to do.
When I was a young journalist, I wasn't even a critic. I was writing some story. I don't even know. I might have been at the Orange County Register. And I made this kind of passing comment about, you know, this job is about as important as the fashion buyer at Fedco, which was like JCPenney. It's long since gone. Just a throwaway line. And the fashion buyer from Fedco called me up and said, I was really hurt by what you wrote. Mm. And I think people who write criticism never really step back and recognize that what they say can hurt people. Mm. And there's a scene in this movie where some of your own words as a critic are played back to you. Mm-hmm. And it really got me thinking about this way that most people don't recognize the hurt that negative thoughts and words can cause.
Well, speaking of being on the jury at Cannes, it was this pretty tremendous honor to be on a jury where the Coen brothers were the presidents. And one of the things they said to us, which I will never forget as long as I watch a movie, was we're going to see a lot at the very beginning. We're going to see a lot of movies in the next couple of weeks. And I think all of us are going to know when there's something we don't necessarily feel like should be awarded something, or that we probably, you know, generally agree is not the quality that we want to award something to. And they said, we would just urge you to look at the positive in those movies, to come back to our discussions and say to us like, well, I really liked her hair, or I really liked that earring she was wearing. And by the way, I think we are in a business where it is so, and we are living in a world where there are a lot of models of, you know, destroying things is so much easier than creating them. And to me, what I would say is any person who can even, I mean, man, can even get the money, however big or small the amount, to even make a film, that is like an enormous feat. There is not enough respect paid to the process that is. And by the way, there are a lot of people doing a lot harder, more interesting jobs. But I would say sometimes that is dismissed in criticism. I think the fact that it's something even gets to Sundance is a triumph. And we are all about this idea of winning. And I think life is really not about that. And I find that a really odd concept to comprehend. That doesn't mean that someone critiques something and it's negative and doesn't hurt. But more and more, I think over the years, I've found it a lot funnier. And playing a critic and finding humor in a critic has given me the opportunity to separate myself from that. Like, there are just people who don't like you, and that's okay. and in fact, that kind of means you made it. You know,
Jake, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
That's a good end.
Jake Gyllenhaal stars in Velvet Buzzsaw. The movie opens in select theaters on January 31st. It will be on Netflix starting February 1st. Coming up, a Sundance documentary about the making of the 79 film classic, Alien.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. We are coming to you today from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. Now, the documentary Memory, The Origins of Alien. The film is written and directed by Alexander Philippe, whose style might be best described as filmmaking deconstruction. His last documentary, 7852, examined in minuscule detail the iconic shower scene in Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. In Memory, his focus is in part about this scene from Alien. If you weren't able to tell already, that's the famous moment where the alien bursts out from a crew member's chest, killing him and escaping into the ship. But the documentary is about much more: the myths that Alien is based upon, how the filmmakers designed the creature, and how it addressed our fears of space and the unknown. I spoke with Alexander Philippe about Memory right before it premiered outside the Egyptian Theater on Main Street in Park City, and I asked him how the sci-fi horror thriller and its alien creature became such an icon of classic cinema.
It's a film that was not supposed to be successful in 1979, in a time when people were, in fact, ready for the friendly, cute, cuddly alien. You look at the success of Star Wars, you look at the success of E.T., of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Alien is a completely, well, alien film, when it came out at that time. But yet, the whole argument of Memory is that it was presenting ideas and images that people needed to process, that we as a collective needed to process. When movies become as successful as Alien does become on the big screen, there's something else that happens here. It's almost like we collectively summon those stories on the big screen because there's something that we need to walk through together. And I think that that's true of every popular film.
The thing that is interesting to me is you spent a lot of time talking about Dan O'Bannon, who was the screenwriter of the film,
yeah,
and the very different things that shaped it. I think there's a line in the film that he didn't really steal from one person, he stole from everybody,
yeah,
but this was really an amalgam of a lot of ideas that he was obsessing about that ended up being things that director Ridley Scott was interested in as well.
That's right. The ideas that you just mentioned, those ideas were around in cinema, but in the B realm. This is the first time that those ideas, those stories, essentially surfaced as an A movie. And that's what made it completely novel. But, of course, Dan O'Bannon needed Giger, and he also needed Ridley Scott to make the film in this particular way.
Let's talk about Giger. His artwork, yeah. I think, for people who aren't familiar with it, you would say mildly to greatly disturbing. I mean, kind of violent
yeah,
imagery.
Sure.
And he ends up being a critical component of the design of the alien. How does he get involved in the project, and why is his contribution so critical to the film?
Those characters, those images already existed before Dan O'Bannon and Giger had actually met. You look at his Necronomicon, specifically the painting Necronom 4, which is essentially the xenomorph pretty much as we now know it. And, the fact that Dan O'Bannon showed the book to Ridley Scott, and Ridley Scott said, that's it, no question about it. It gives you the sense that those three, they were resonating with the same ideas, the same stories, the same mythological characters, and I would even argue probably not necessarily without consciously knowing what they were doing. It just happened to be the perfect storm.
You said Memory was a very hard movie for you to make. Why was it hard, but why was it important? Why did you not want to walk away from telling the story of Alien?
We didn't fully have the budget that we needed to make this film, so that always makes it really, really hard. There's a number of people that we went after for interviews that said no, or that, the schedule didn't work. And it's a movie that changed drastically from the early inspiration, which was essentially I wanted initially to make a movie just about the chestburster scene. And then when I started really realizing that it was essentially a mythological film about Alien, it opened this whole, Pandora's box, if you will, of ideas and threads that had to be explored. So it was in the writing process, I had to wrestle a lot with that film. But I do feel very strongly it's the best one we've ever made.
You are clearly a movie nut, yes?
Yeah.
This is a documentary that makes people who don't know much about filmmaking, and even people who do, to kind of re-examine the way they watch mm-hmm. and understand a movie like Alien.
Yeah.
Did you change the way that you saw and understood the movie through making it?
Oh, completely. I mean, when you start digging into those influences, this is where it gets amazing. You know, we got to interview this amazing gentleman. His name is Will Lin. He's connected to the Joseph Campbell Foundation, and his thoughts about the mythological roots in Alien and the resonance of myth are quite extraordinary. I mean, I feel like, you know, and he says it actually in the film, he says you can never get to the bottom of Alien. And I feel very much the same way with the great movies. Psycho, Citizen Kane, 2001. I mean, you go down the list, The Exorcist. Those are movies that the more you look at them, the more you study them, the more there is to see, because not everything in those films is conscious. They draw from images and ideas that we have carried as humans for thousands of years across civilizations. And it's just an endless source of inspiration for me to dig into those films and then to be able to present that to an audience. It's a thrill.
It's one thing to set out to make a movie. It's another thing to finish the movie. It's another thing to bring it to an audience.
Yep.
And then it's another thing entirely to get it distributed. So you are 3/4 of the way through that process.
Yep.
What is it like bringing a movie to Sundance and looking for a home for it, to have your baby more or less up for auction?
Yeah, well, you know, it's where you want to be, you know. It's the ultimate place, I think, to get a film noticed and sold, and certainly on opening night. It's just amazing. I'm still pinching myself. But, you know, I don't know who's going to take the film. You know, the reactions I'm hoping are going to be really good. You know, now it's out of my hands. I've done my job. We have a great team, and they know what to do with the film. And I think people who have the vision to know how to distribute this film will come to us and hopefully with a good enough offer.
Alexander Philippe is the writer and director of the documentary Memory. It's premiering at the Sundance Film Festival. Alexander, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
And that is The Frame for today from Park City, Utah. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow for more from the Sundance Film Festival.